Morris Special. In the run-up to a new exhibition at Morris, House for Contemporary Culture in Maastricht, director Valentine Bivank interviews participating artists, performers, and curators.
Hello everyone, my name is Valentin Bijfunk. I'm director of MARIS, House for Contemporary Culture in Maastricht. And today I'll be interviewing Tonatiuh Lopez, and he is the co-curator together with Laura Martinez of the exhibition Vultures and Fireflies by the Mexican artist Alejandro Galván. And I hope to get a little bit of background for the exhibition because Tonatiuh has been involved since the very beginning of this show with the concept, really. And maybe that would be also my first question. How did it start?
How does it start? Well, hello, everyone. My name is Tonatiuh Lopez, and as Valentin said, I'm the co-creator of Vultures and Fireflies. How did it start? Well, first, it started with you kind of discovering Alex, not discovering him, but like finding him and like being attracted, or I don't know how to say it, by his work. And then it was his will to make this kind of Divina Comedia. And that for me is something really important. It's something that it's written on the book and on the leaflets of the exhibition, the fact that he wanted to do like sort of Divina Comedia of Mexican life, especially Mexican life in the outskirts of Mexico City, which is our life. I mean, he and me and Laura, we all come from the outskirts of Mexico City. That's where we grew up, and that's where that's where we learned to love and to live. And so it started there.
Maybe you can describe a bit what growing up in Nezahualcóyotl.
Yeah, like in the case of Nezahualcóyotl, which is where Laura and Alejandro came from, and in the case of Mexico City, of Ecatepec, which is where I come from, those territories are territories that have a longer history than the city itself. But it seems that it's not that way because they grew tremendously because of the growing of the city during the 90s. The beginning of the 90s, were the years also of the NAFTA, and those were the years also of the entering of Mexico into globalization.
NAFTA is North American Trade Agreement.
With Canada and the U.S. With Canada and the U.S. So there was this kind of hope in the air for all the people living in Mexico. And there were social programs to fight poverty. So there was this idea of time will change for good for us. And then we really trusted those hopes. And at the end, nothing happened. And probably the globalization brought more problems than solutions for us. And in a matter of 5 years, the population in the city growth in a 2 million people per year, especially in the outskirts of the city. So it came from having 12 million people to having 18 million people from 1991 to 1994. And most of those millions of people were living in the outskirts of the city, like Nezahualcóyotl or Ecatepec. And of course, the landscape changed like brutally, quickly. And not only the landscape, but also the social relationships. Like the local people were somehow not really happy that some invaders...
New people came in.
That new people came in. Yeah.
What did it look like on street level? I mean, you lived on through it. When you grow up?
Wonderful. For me, it was wonderful. The place where I live, which is a little bit different from Nessa, but the place where I live in Ecatepec, I mean, I had a river close by, and the streets were in... They didn't have concrete on. It was more like a rural life, even if it was like, I don't know, 20... 30 minutes from the city, but it was still like a rural life. So there were crops and there were cows and there were rabbits. And But in the case of Neza, Neza was, it was called the salt desert. And it was because in Neza, there was also in Ecatepec, but in Neza, it was a part of the lake, of Mexico City Lake, that used to be the salines, where the water was more salted. So it became dried, and it became basically like a desert of salt. Yeah. It's still a problem there now because the earth is so salty that the buildings there have a lot of problems with saltpeter, and they get like, they get corrosed, or I don't know how to say it, but it's still a problem there. It's a heavy problem there. But so Neza was one of the latest municipalities to be erected in Mexico, in the state of Mexico, that was erected like around the 60s to build up this like sort of dorm city for people coming, for migrants coming from the inside of the country.
Now, I back you up a little bit because first you say there's a lot of influx of people coming into these neighborhoods. And then when I ask you to describe what it was like, you say it was wonderful. But so many people coming in was not in itself a problem for these areas.
It was a problem. Because, for example, when I was a little kid, like 1 to 5, 6 years old, we still could go up to the mountains like to hunt for things. Mm-hmm. It was not hunting, but we were collecting snails that we ate, or we were collecting cactuses that we ate. Mm-hmm. And that stopped within like 4 years. Like, because we start feeling that going up to the mountains wasn't safe. And it was more a matter of perception. Ecatepec, for instance, is the place in Mexico with the most higher perception of insecurity. That doesn't mean it's insecure, but people living there, 99% of the people living there feel
that they're unsafe.
Yeah. But that's because of how it grow, because it grows tremendously quickly and without a plan. So everyone was building up wherever they could. And that was the thing. In Neza was different, because in Neza, the growth of Neza was way before. It was in the 60s and 70s. And it was because of another moment on the Mexican economy that was called the Milagro Mexicano, or the Mexican Miracle. And it was also related to like a relation with the U.S., but especially after the Second World War, and how the industries in Mexico
new jobs, grew, new industries,
new jobs, new industries, everything. Yeah. And then a lot of people move again from this the inside the country to in this case Neza and build that city. Yeah. Neza is a small city, and it's a small city. When I say small city, it's like 60 kilometers, square kilometers. So it's a small city, but it has a matter of 17,000 people per square kilometer living. Yeah, it's very densely populated, So, and that created other kind of problems, you know.
Yeah. You have compared the city where you come from as described by many other people as the hell. So what does crowding change into this idyllic life? Like, we would go up and we collect snails and there was space and there was a river. Maybe you swam in the river. So then you get a lot of people. There's no maybe so much social cohesion between these people, and you start to feel unsafe. But on the other hand, you also have a lot of people that are maybe trying to find their luck and do it in any way they can. And so they push other people out and you get violence and whatever.
Yeah.
And this is, I think, also very much in the DNA of the stories that you tell about these outskirts. There's too many people wanting too many things, and somewhere you get friction, no?
Yeah. Like if there is a problem or if there is something to be fixed, there are too many opinions and too many different wills trying to do what they want. There is no sense of community in those territories.
Or there are many.
Or there are many senses of community happening, but each of them is pulling to a different
direction.
Side. Yeah, direction. Yeah. Yeah. So because there are the gangs, or there are the drug gangs, or there are the family. Yeah, and each of them are pulling towards what they think it's their welfare or their wellness.
Sure.
And most of the people doesn't care if they have to step on the others to achieve their goals.
And there's
goals.
Not a strong state or a police system to protect.
There's nothing like that. There.
Let's go a little bit from okay, this is where you come from. Where you started out and then I stopped you for a bit. You say there's no way you come from that neighborhood and you're an artist.
There was no way you came from that neighborhood and you were an artist. I mean, there were ways. And there, we have had artists in those neighborhoods from the beginning of the times of those neighborhoods, but not in the what one would think of contemporary artists or like educated in art schools, or that's something recent. Even a generation before ours, we are in our 30s. So people who are in their 50s, I mean, they were already studying art in the city and then trying to find ways to develop their art practice in our towns. Like, for example, I had art teachers at my school. And that was something important that led me towards art. But it wasn't that common, and you still had to face a lot of prejudice. What is it to become an artist? What you gonna do with your life? How you gonna solve your material problems? And there is this image of if you are an artist, you are basically doing nothing of your life in a place where life is so difficult to live, it's almost a sin for all the community, you know, because it's like you are, what are you doing for your life? And then what are you doing for our life? That is somehow we can take profit out of it. That is changing now.
Yeah.
And
how so?
Because we started creating our own spaces within our communities, and we started showing our people why our practice is important there, and what is the things that we can provide the community that it's not that they cannot do it by themselves, because it's not that way, but they are starting to figure out that artists make sense there, which before it wasn't that way. And in talking about the work of Alex, is like for most of the people there, even for me, when I saw the first time one of his paintings, it was the first time that I saw myself or people like me represented in a big work of art.
What do you see? What does it look like?
Well, it was a concrete wall of, I don't know, like 4 meter long per 2 meter. It was like a genre scene of people just wandering the streets, like whores and drug addicts and like young people and a lot of dogs. And there was this huge dog, like a little bit frightened and a little bit menacing, like looking at the viewer, and he was about to attack. And then there was a virgin on the top, like kind of suffering for all of the crowd who was below her, cleaning all their sins with her cry. I mean, as someone who likes art there, I always felt more identified, and I think for Alex is the same, with those people, the people who has nothing to do or who were doing nothing but just contemplating life, or provoking themselves like some other state of minds with substances or alcohol or, you know, people who deeply didn't want it to be there or who deeply were suffering to be there, wanting to be somewhere else in a state of mind or physically, because of many reasons. And yeah, that was it. And I felt he was somehow portraying that, you know, like someone who feel trapped in a place where he, as I said before, have learned how to love and in a way love that place and knows deeply that he won't find, I'm talking about myself, that he won't find any other place like that in the world. But living in a place like that is such a hell, in some sense. And when I said hell, it's not that hell is a bad thing, you know? In the Christian way of seeing hell, in hell, a lot of suffering takes place. It's not about punishments. It's about suffering. And it's about guilt. And it's about...
What guilt?
Well, the guilt of being yourself, you know? And in those places, the guilt is being poor. The guilt is being brown skin. The guilt is being, I don't know, like, as I said before, being a drug addict or being, or yeah, whatever. That's, you're guilty because of being born, basically. And you start to pay your...
and condemn. Almost every way out is a failure.
Almost every way out is
it's a failure. Yeah. It's like either you sell drugs or you sell your body or you have a lowly job, or even an artist would be a failure within that context.
Yeah.
Because you don't become somebody who raises up the community in money or whatever.
Or even if you, like, let's say, even if you become a famous artist and you go... That's even that it's a failure, because you would be a traitor of the neighborhood.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you would be someone who was not loyal to its own reality, you know? Because once you're born there, you're supposed to remain there. Even everything is telling you, like, go out of here.
Yeah.
What's expected from you is to stay there, be proud, and keep on going.
And to a certain extent, you agree.
Yeah, somehow you agree, because most of the people you love are there. And because, as I said, that's a place where we learn how to love. And that's the only place where we feel, I'm talking now again about myself, but I'm sure for Alex and Laura is the same. That's also the place where we, the only place where we feel in a way loved in the same way, because it's very difficult. And it's also very difficult to be always explaining to the others, oh, that's the way I love, or that's the way I live, because it's that way, you know? And I think that talking about the exhibition and the planning and the amazing adventure that you took, being from a completely different context, to bring artists from that kind of context here, I think that's something, those are some things of the problems that you experienced at the exhibition planning and, like, bringing it up. Like you know, like, there was a lot of lost in translation. The way feelings are said, and it's something very specific of the way we grow and of the way we manage violence and of the way we manage, or we have learned how to deal with also being close to others, you know, because we are not really in those places. As I said, with this huge growth and, like, people coming from other places, but you mistrusting them, but on a way you have to relate with them in order to feel safe, but not really as a friend, but more like you have to take big care of the, take care of the other and learn how to untrust them in a safe way, let's say, without telling that much that you are not trusting them, but being friendly. But it's a really complex thing, because you don't want to mess with the bad guys, but you want them to be your friends because that way you will feel protected. But it becomes really like a mess in terms of how to manage feelings and how to ask for things to be done.
And you feel that described also the process of making this exhibition.
Yeah.
Because you want to, on the one hand, you want to show gratitude for this opportunity. And on the other hand, I think our feeling in the team also often was we cannot get to the depth of this, what you are telling. We can never match the energy and the urgency of your plight and what you're going to tell
here,
no?
In the exhibition, there are a lot of installations and of ambience that recreate spaces of the suburbs of Mexico City and spaces that for us are really important and some of them even sacred, like the party spaces or like those places that are in the street where we honor our loss, the people we lost, in a violent way, and also the way our houses are made by ourselves, So there are a lot of feelings for us put there. Mm-hmm. And I understand those lost in translation things as that, for Alex and Laura especially, it was so important that the things were as they were having them in mind, that they weren't able to realize why the others weren't somehow catching the thing at the first point.
Seeing into their minds.
Yeah. But it was more that it was, and that's what I tried to do in the leaflet text or in some other materials, that you have to go to the feelings more than, because we all share the need of a house.
Yeah.
And we all share the tiredness of being working hard and coming back. Or we all share the fear of dark night on a street, a narrow street without lights. We all share that, Bodies feel the same, in some sort of situations. We all feel loved in some situations. We all feel happy in a party ambient. We all feel when a party ambient is turning into something sketchy or edgy and we need to run from there. We share that. And at the end, I think there was a great coping within the Maris team, Laura and Alex especially, because they were based here and producing here. And the magic happened, that people who go to see the exhibition, they can really feel at some points what people there is feeling. And that, I think that's the important thing of the exhibition. I was talking with Bibi, and Bibi was saying that in front of some paintings, some people were asking, is this Gaza? And it's not Gaza, but it kind of be, and it kind of feels like that, it's a place where violence and danger, it's in the order of the day, And having that possibility to connect with other places who are also suffering from violence, of course, in a broader way or a much different way, but they are suffering, mm-hmm. That there is human suffering there. I think that's an important thing.
Yeah. I can imagine for Maris, it's very important to use, in a sense, art to make people aware of other worlds, to open up worlds for them. right? To see suddenly that people are living in completely different circumstances than us. So we have work to do when we encounter it and try to figure out what does it say to us? What does this mean to us? And do you think now you brought with Laura and Alejandro this show to Marés, do you see that this is a thing that works? Or because sometimes I'm afraid it will be an isolated thing, right? We come and make a beautiful show and then we take it all back. We go on with our lives in the outskirts of Mexico City. The people who come to the show say there's beautiful paintings, you know, and we go on to the other show. That's my biggest fear, really, of what can happen.
Well, I think that art is always, for me, it's always like a pretext for something else to happen. Either because you feel something, either because you get mad, or even if you don't feel anything and you ask yourself, well, what the fuck, why is this here, you know? But then something else needs to happen. I mean, like, if you feel something, it's not enough. You have to turn that feeling into a conversation with someone in order for that to have an impact on something. And I think that what has happened during the process or what is happening after the process with things like the book or with the work with the volunteers or even this podcast is that thing, creating conversation around things that may change some ideas on some stuff. When you were talking about hell, there's one thing that I really wanted to comment on that. Because when we talk about hell, when we talk about the devil or things like that, it's not in the same way that can be thought probably from a Western point of view. The way I want people who are listening to us to imagine it is that I always say that this time somehow is the time of the devil, and not in a bad meaning, or also in a bad meaning, but for me, it's especially in a good way. Because most of the souls that has been delivered to his care, the indigenous people, the gay people, the trans people, you know, like in that imaginative way of thinking of who were going to hell and who were going to heaven, most of the people who were going to hell are now rising and asking for their rights. And for me, in a way, all the spirits of the people before us that were punished for being like us are in a way coming out of that place to protect us and to help us somehow in our rising, let's say, or at least to shine below us or to make their glow, to transfer their glow to us. There are also other kind of people in hell, like the bad governors or the bad kings or the fascist people, or, you know, and the problem with having the doors of hell open, it's that they are also coming out. And we can see that in the world too, you know, like Trump or all this ultra-right or
are right-wing. Also coming out.
Yeah, they are also coming out. And we somehow have to manage the life in hell in a way that they don't win and that we use the demons, let's say, or that all those people that were living in hell in like in a good way to fight those bad forces, you know, and to be really careful on how we rescue I have a Catholic background, so on how we rescue the souls of those who suffer like us so they can fight within us and at the same time, like somehow putting away those other bad forces that could come when hell is open. And there are some pieces in the exhibition that talks about this.
I mean, I was just going to ask you, lift one out.
The diorama, the room in the which is called Mount Carmel. I think it's about that. So Alex This piece is a reference to a piece, I don't remember name of the painter, but it's a symbolist painter from the 19th century, French painter. And he made a painting of Jesus taken out of hell by the devil and put it into the pinnacle. And the painting is impressive because it's more like an illustration. There is a huge devil, like spirit, like carrying Christ and putting into the pinnacle after he's dead. And what Alex did was to turn this devil spirit into a Gundam, which is a robot from a Japanese manga series. And he's also carrying Christ, and he's rising it up to heaven across what could be thought as our hell, you know, like a mountain with all this housing and, yeah, all these houses and all this mixed of stuff, you know. And what I wrote for the leaflet is that in order Christ could go out of hell, there should be some help of the devil. I'm talking like in a fictional way.
He's complicit.
Yeah, yeah. You know, like, or he either do something, or even if he didn't oppose it, he did something, you know, for that to happen. And that's, if there is a prayer I could say we say the most in those places, it's not only God protect us, but devil don't do nothing to us, you know?
And maybe good to contextualize, the diorama is like a piece of sculpture. It looks like it's as big as half an old-fashioned telephone booth, right? Where there's a city on the bottom that starts with Maya remains and then has a hill with towns on it and houses and then a garbage heap. And then, like many of the works of Alejandro Gavan, there's this spirit hanging above, like a mythological spirit.
Creature,
whether you call it a creature, whether you call it a devil or an angel or a
demon.
He calls
them titans.
Titans.
I think it's more accurate because it's titans. like a spirit there who's protecting or either menacing.
And it actually resembles the form of the altars that people make outside of their houses.
Yeah.
And that gives some, let's say, a hope to the people that need to go home late at night and there's no proper lighting. So there you have the little altars through which you find your way home.
Yeah. And I think that one thing that you learn coming from those places is that the good ones are not that good at all and the bad ones are not that bad at all, you know? And that thing, I think it's something that is good because that's how life is, you know?
Yeah.
Like good people are not really completely
so good.
And bad people are not completely bad. And it's our decision how we decide to act and towards what. And that's why the titans are so big and there. But in a way, they are not helping the disaster and they are not helping the good things happening at the paintings, because there are also a lot of tenderness in those when you see when you see the paintings, it's more like, oh, this is a disaster, but when you start looking at things, you see that there is a lot of love there, and especially because many of the people he is portraying are his beloved ones. So when you start looking, there are also some ugly stuff now.
There's
I'm
all
seeing.
Kinds.
There
everything,
are all
everything
kinds,
is in it. But I've seen grandmothers with babies, dancing people, kissing people.
Coming back to the title of the exhibition and where it all began. When we started having discussions on how we're gonna call this, and he had this idea of the hell and the Divina Commedia, but I didn't want it to be so centered in the idea of hell and the good ones and the bad ones and all the moral thing that it has behind. I tried to think of metaphors that could allow us to somehow grasp those two big powers of not the good and the evil, no, but the kind of death forces and the kind of love forces that are within the paintings. And those two metaphors, the one of the vultures as a kind of shadow that somehow spreads mm-hmm. and covers all what's happening. But in a way, it's a bad force, but it's also like a natural force because they are all looking for food, and they're vultures are there for a reason. And then the fireflies that in that kind of darkness, they kind of small
light up.
Yeah, they light up, and they are like small stars, you know, like in a ground level. Mm. Which I think it's for me the best thing I could have get of growing in such a place, that you learn how to shine at a ground level. Mm. And that's good, you know, because those kind of neighborhood rules of don't betray the neighborhood, be loyal to yourself, don't forget where you come from. I think those are some of the best lessons I could have get in life. And I think for Alex is the same.
We'd be making the book together with the exhibition, and yet it's its own path. What was your idea for the book? What did you think the book would do that the exhibition maybe to some sense couldn't?
Yeah. I mean, for me, the book was an important thing. Because, I mean, Alejandro's work is strong enough and already says a lot about our reality. But I knew, as I was saying, that even if there were some ambience in the exhibition that could help to understand the kind of context and the sort of feelings that people living those situations would feel, there were missing the stories of the lives of the people living there. Mm-hmm. Even if they are depicted in the paintings, I think that once you tell the story, especially like in a written way, then you can grasp more information and you can feel different things than what you're feeling in the rooms or watching at the paintings.
For me, it's also, if I may go in between, it's like you created a community behind the paintings. It's like, so the paintings you can see and you can find your way about thinking something of it or what's their taste. But it is with these essays, like people are standing up behind the paintings.
That was the way I worked. Like I looked at the paintings and I saw who are living in these paintings and who are the voices or of the writers that could come out of the painting, you know? And that way we selected 10 authors.
And could you say something about how you selected them? Are they all from your neighborhoods, for instance?
They are from similar contexts. Of the ones Alejandro and I grew in. Some of them were close friends to Alex and had already written of his work before. And some others were like really strong voices that are doing different things in Mexico City, where in Mexico. And I think that there are a lot of unheard voices there. For instance, the work of Samuel Segura, which is one of the ones I like the most, or that of Lidiet, they deal with really complex feelings of how is it to deal with violence and how is it to defend your beloved ones in such a violent context. There are also some sort of critical voices like that of Racia Santillan, which is an activist, a trans woman art activist from Mexico City who has passed through a lot of things. And it's the first time she's writing in a book.
It's very fresh writing. Huh? It's very good. It's
very
like
pointy.
Here.
Yeah. Yeah. It's that's She's amazing. She's amazing. And for us, it was an honor that her decided to collaborate with us. And she was also really happy that she was invited to collaborate in a book, because that's not the kind of offers, job offers that she received. And I think that should change, you know, because she is a great writer.
Yes.
And that was also an important part of the book. When you were saying that we were creating a community, it was not only a community like within the paintings and but also a community within us, like, you know. Also, what happens with Samuel or what happens with Lidiette is that Lidiette, for instance, the reason why we decided to invite her is because she already had a huge and amazing research work from a journalist's point of view on femicides that happen in the state of Mexico and of the bodies of women that are thrown into the canals and the rivers there. And
which is also the subject of one of the rooms in the exhibition.
Which is also the subject of one of the rooms in the exhibition, Ophelia. And we felt that it was important for Alex not only to have the story in the book, but also to have someone that has, in a way, lived that in first person, so he could dialogue with it. He could get, and it's, even if he is talking of experience of himself, in a way to honor the lives of that people and to do it in a really respectful way. The works of Alex, like, somehow depict a universe which is not that it is directly related to the text, but they somehow live in the same,
universe.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's how I think all very good shows with books need to be. Not one an illustration of the other.
Yeah.
But two actually different worlds that speak to the same.
And then
story
we need to talk also about the great work that Teresa Miller did with the design, taking some reference of death metal, which Alex is a big fan, and also like playing a lot with color and to bring
fonts.
Some rhythm with fonts and images to the text, which I think is really good. And it's also important to say that the book is not only a catalog, but it presents a sort of a review of the production of Alex from the last 5 years, but it also shows in a strong part what has been shown here at Mares and what I could say is his biggest project done until now, which we thank Mares for commissioning.
Tell me, maybe we go slowly to an end of this very beautiful conversation. What do you walk away with? I mean, you remember how you got into this project, that we had a lot of Zoom meetings and a lot of lost in translations. We were working on the book. We saw each other in Mexico City. Now you're here. What has happened?
What has happened? Well, I remember when I got the invitation, I was passing through a not really nice moment of my life. And I went with Laura to have a tarot reading. And then there was this lady, and I asked her a question, but it was not about this, but then I realized it could be about this. But I told her, like, I have this book in mind. It was not this book. Do you think I have to write it? And she said she's apparently saw a book, and then she told me, like, yeah, you have to do it because that's going to help a lot of people. I'm not sure that the book I had in mind would have helped a lot of people. And it's, as I said before, that when you're dealing with art, you can go for that thing and probably lie yourself a bit and say, yeah, what I'm going to do, it's going to help a lot of people. And then, or you can go the other way, which it's something, or the way I like to think. So I don't know if I help a lot of people, but I know we help like the 10 people who are writing in the book in different ways. And I know that you have helped us commissioning this exhibition. And I know that in a way we have helped you to understand deeply our culture, which is something, understanding the culture of others is it's always a thing that you that make you a better person, you know? And I think that's the importance of this exhibition here, you know? That you can see, and there are, when you see the paintings, for sure you will have like a lot of questions and you will say like, what the fuck am I looking at? But then if you start looking deeper and if you read at the book, if you read at the leaflet, you will start understanding and you will see that it's not that far from the way of living you have here or the way of living you have either. I mean, we are the same. We are humans. I don't want a thing in terms of binaries, like we are better or we are worse or we are good or this is bad. But I think that what I came out with after this experience is it's a great experience, you know. It was an opportunity for my friends to know Europe and also for them to know another culture and to know other ways of working. It was an opportunity for us to reaffirm that the things we are working and also for the people in the book are worth it, you know, and that they're worth a lot and that they need to be done and that art needs to be used to keep on telling these stories. It's not that we have to lose hope or think that what we are doing it's not worth it or we should stop doing. So that's what I take out of this. I don't feel a better person because of doing this. But I feel,
but you're sure that I got better.
Yeah, but you got better. Yeah. Nah. But good things happen and that's enough.
Yeah.
I think it's not about being good or bad. No. It's about making good things happen.
Yeah. I think that's putting an end to this interview.
Yeah. Thank you.
Very good. Very nice. Thank you. To everybody out there, this was an interview with Donatia Lopez about the exhibition Vultures and Fireflies and the book, the beautiful book Vultures and Fireflies. Both very beautiful things. At the House of Mares in Maastricht. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Valentin Beyerfunk and hope to see you soon at another Mares podcast. Bye.